How can you keep Shakespeare's plays relevant? Play them. That's what Sean Ed Jones, director of Shakespeare in the Square's recent production of The Tempest, believes. Sean Ed is an actress and theater maker with credits in the West End, at the National Theater, on television, and in film. She's here today to discuss her version of The Tempest, which premiered in London last month. Shakespeare in the Squares is a non-profit touring theater company that stages a Shakespeare play in garden squares across London every summer. The company works with local organizations to make the play specific to each location and celebrate the community. One of their patrons, the esteemed Dame Judi Dench, says about the company that, to take William Shakespeare, whose timeless plays always have something important to say about the human condition, into idyllic gardens and other iconic spaces, offers a great opportunity to engage new and non-traditional audiences of all ages. Today, Sean Ed will talk with us about how The Tempest fosters community coming out of lockdown, the themes that continue to be relevant to modern audiences, and the challenge of chairs, helicopters, and more in a touring garden performance space. With that, here is Sean Ed. Sean Ed, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Emily. I'm very excited to be here. Thank you.
Yes, we're excited to have you. So you are here in the capacity as director of Shakespeare in the Square's production of The Tempest. But tell me a bit about your background in theatre. You're an actor as well, aren't you?
Oh, God, yes. I've been an actor for over 30 years, a professional actor. Yes. So you could say I'm a very late emerging director.
When did you begin sort of your foray into the direction world?
I directed one or two things as a student and bits and pieces along the way. But this is most definitely the biggest production that I've directed, certainly.
Oh, that's wonderful. How did you get involved in it?
Well, I worked for Shakespeare in the Squares back in 2019. I was lucky enough to get to play Titania and Hippolyta in A Midsummer Night's Dream with the amazing Tati Hennessy, who was directing. And she'd directed the last sort of four productions, and she was deciding to step down. And that's when I said to her, well, would you mind if I threw my hat in the ring? Because I've always wanted to direct. So, and she was very supportive.
What about directing made you want to go for it?
Well, the thing is, I also paint, and I've acted, so it's kind of getting to paint on a very on the biggest canvas, if you like, with real live people, and I like the collaboration. And my background at Exeter University was very much devising. The course there was all about being a theatre maker. So and it was really nice to get to envisage the thing beforehand a little bit. But that's always really plan B, you know, because plan A is whatever happens in the room with the people as well, you know, what they contribute, what the other actors bring.
Yeah. Well, give me just a brief overview of your career as an actor as well before we get into this production.
I trained at Exeter University and then did a postgraduate at Webber Douglas, a diploma in acting. I've been really fortunate in that I've sort of managed to travel all over the UK and various places in the world with the job, which has been great. I took a one-woman show to Kathmandu in 2018. That was great fun. I love the Nepalese people. They are amazing people. That was truly tremendous.
That's wonderful. Then tell me about getting involved with Shakespeare in the Squares in 2019. Was that your first season with them?
That was my first season with them, yes. And the thing about Shakespeare in the Squares is there's something quite raw about it because there's no electric lighting, no pre-recorded music. Everything is live. There's no stage. There's seats for the audience to sit on. But other than that, it's gorgeous costumes and gorgeous surroundings in the parks and the gardens where they play. But it's...
For our listeners, give us a sort of overview of what Shakespeare in the Square does. You know, I know that you're a touring company. You tour around different parks and gardens in London. But yeah, tell us a bit about that.
Well, that's right. I mean, the thing is, a lot of the parks and gardens that we do get to play in are actually normally closed to the public. So it's also an opportunity for the public to get in and have a good nose around and have a look at these beautiful gardens. They are sort of behind some of the Georgian houses that are around sort of Notting Hill and Holland Park, and they tend to be gated gardens, so it's a kind of a chance to get in there and have a really good look at these beautiful old, they're very old, sometimes the trees are sort of 200 years old in these gardens. They're huge and very leafy and very quiet, actually, considering they're right in the middle of London. And then we also play bigger outdoor spaces, like we're in Little Wormwood Scrubs, which is a huge field, essentially, with some very lovely willow trees. And people come and they, you know, the ethos is bring your picnic, bring your blanket, bring your family, bring a bottle of something and have a lovely evening. And it's that spirit that the show is. It's about coming together. It's about having a nice evening with people you like and just being entertained a bit and having a bit of fun.
Tell me a bit about your production of The Tempest. Is it true that you were planning on doing this before the world shut down in 2020?
Yes, yes. I was really hoping to get to direct a big play before I was 50, and that didn't happen.
Oh.
But basically what they said to me when I threw my hat in the ring when Tati had said she was stepping down, I said, I'd be interested in doing it. And they said, well, what play would you do? And at that point, I hadn't really thought about it. And I started to think about all the plays that happen outdoors and what would be best suited. And straight away I said, well, obviously, if it rains, it doesn't matter if you're doing The Tempest, because it would be part and parcel of it.
It's immersive theatre.
It is, it is. And I have to say, last night we had some spectacular special effects. We had a...
Oh, no!
Yeah, we had a few showers. They weren't, fortunately, they weren't very heavy, but we had the most gorgeous rainbows in the sky. And that was an extraordinarily dramatic lighting with the sort of setting sun, dark, lowering clouds and rainbows and light spattering of rain. Yeah, it was beautiful.
Oh, that's magical.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly feels very real when you're outdoors there with the elements. And
Sure.
The audience are fantastic. They actually sort of brace themselves for it. You hear for a couple of minutes is the rustling of ponchos, and then everybody sits down and they're very happy because they can go home and say, we stayed through the rain.
Yes. Fought it out.
We did.
Like we were on the island.
Yeah.
So tell me a bit about your production of The Tempest. What was your vision for this production?
Well, every version of The Tempest I'd ever seen had always had at its heart a really bitter, angry old man. And to my mind, he doesn't have to be old. And we have the most delightful Prospero Ellis Kirkhoven, who is just brilliant. And he is a warm dad with an interest in the liberal arts, which sort of distract him from parenting quite properly.
Yeah.
He's full of love, actually. And one of the things that I thought from in the heart of this version of The Tempest is that it's about forgiveness rather than full-on festering revenge. The initial thought is, when he discovers that his enemies land on the island, is that he can take his revenge. But what he learns through the play is almost that he is as much responsible for the fact that his brother usurped him as his brother for trying to usurp, because he wasn't paying attention. He had the responsibility of being the Duke, and he was spending too much time doing magic. And in our version, the magic is music. And that was, The Tempest is so imbued and infused with music. I think it probably has the most music, I think, of the Shakespeare plays.
And definitely.
Regularly, so many of the pieces have had very famous settings composed for them. And for me, every time he conjures a spell, we have some kind of music. We've got the most incredibly gifted violinist and beautiful performer called Phyllis Ho playing Ariel, and she darts about with her violin. So he has his, instead of having a big stick as a staff, he has a baton. He's in a conductor's tailcoat, and Emily Stewart, who's done the design, has done the most fantastic work, and her incredible team have created the most incredible costumes that conjure that sort of magic and island sort of feel.
That's beautiful. And is the violin the principal instrument, or do you have any others?
Oh no, we have an amazing array. The cast are just incredibly talented. I am so lucky to have such an incredible cast. I have an amazing woman called Laura Gomez Gracia, who plays the saxophone brilliantly, has an incredible voice, and she also plays Gonzala and the goddess Juno, and she brings a huge amount to the performance. We've got great comic turns with Will Shackleton and with Sasha Wilson, and they double up as well. And they get to play the villains that we love to hate, and also the funny comedians as well. And they play guitar, and everyone plays percussion of some description. We've got a phenomenal Miranda, who's a real tomboy. I just thought, you know, if you grow up on an island, she doesn't care about what she looks like or...
No, she doesn't even know.
No, she doesn't know. She has a little bit of mirror. She talks about she's never seen a woman's face apart from In My Glass, Mine Own.
Right.
But she is strong. She's feisty. She grew up on this island. Her father's taken care of her mind, educating her. And I think that up until things go awry before the start of the play, she and Caliban have probably hung out and played together an awful lot, you know, and she's learned about the island from him. So I think, you know, our Miranda very much is there at the beginning in a pair of trousers running around and you know, helping to carry the logs and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
She's feisty and strong and knows her own mind. She's a wonderful, wonderful creation by Indigo Griffiths. She's done a gorgeous job with her.
Well, and she does try to help Ferdinand with the logs, you're right.
She does. And yeah. And our Ferdinand is doubled with Caliban because, to my mind, it was interesting to think, you know, very often I'd seen productions in earlier years where Caliban was this kind of misshapen monster and it was all about his appearance and it was all about that. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting if actually the monster and the suitor were kind of played by the same person, and actually it's the behavior that differentiates them, not what they look like. So that's interested me as an idea, and it's played beautifully by Wilf Wallsworth, who's a brand new actor. I think this is kind of his professional debut. He's still training on springboard at the Lyric, but he is so talented. He's one to watch for the future, for sure.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. Well, and tell me, you were talking a bit about Prospero as this loving character, which I think there's so much merit to that. I love that. Tell me about how that takes place in his relationship with Caliban, because that is sort of where we see him being truly a bit cruel.
It is. The thing about it is you always have to go back and ask, well, why has it happened like that? And when you look at the speeches, Caliban himself says, you know, when you first came here, you stroked me and you made much of me and gave me water with berries to drink and taught me language and things like that. And you go, so what went wrong? And then you discover that Caliban attempted to rape Miranda. And at that point, obviously, Prospero's fatherliness kicks in and he tries to keep him, you know, keep Caliban at arm's length. Prospero, expels him from the cell where they've been living together and all of those things. And I think from the one side, you can completely understand a father's need to protect his daughter, particularly on an island when she's coming of age and there's no help and she might get pregnant and anything might happen. And, you know, that could mean her life. And on the other hand, for Caliban, he has not come from civilization. What he's done is he's been watching creatures grow up on the island and, procreate on the island. And he's probably reached his teenage years and feels a stirring in his loins. And he's just following his natural instinct. So he doesn't understand what he's done wrong. And suddenly he goes from being this loved creature, this loved entity that's been part of a family. And he's cast out and he doesn't fully understand why, because he doesn't understand the niceties of civilization. And I think when you look at it in that sense, then nobody's a monster and nobody's, you know, they're all just protecting their interests. And if you go into why people behave the way they do, it makes sense. And this is the thing.
Well, and to that end, with Caliban protecting his interests, this play is obviously one that explores colonialism and imperialism. And you mentioned in your director's note that how this play plays into the Black Lives Matter movement that's been going on, you know, for the last several years, it's taken center stage. So tell me a bit about how your production is tackling those themes.
I have to be honest, I don't think it does tackle those themes.
Hard to tackle.
I'm not a maker of political theatre. I'm not. My mission is something else. I think the most honest thing I can do is present it and, credit the audience with the intelligence to know what's being presented to them and what the themes of the piece are. They know that their audiences are fearfully bright. They know exactly what's going on. And, it's they can see exactly what's happening. They know what's going on. The reason I think it has resonance is precisely because of the themes in it, is because after COVID, we'd all been locked down for so long. We've all been marooned on an island for a long time. And there's a kind of collective coming out. And it was just incredible how the Black Lives Movement, how it surged during that time. And then finding all those resonances in this play as well. The legacy that has been left behind. And I think even Shakespeare acknowledged that by writing about it at the time, showing somebody who had the imperial power and showing how he behaved firstly, with Ariel as well, finding somebody pinned in a tree, releasing them from that, but then giving them, servitude until they'd performed a certain number of tasks before he agreed to release them. So he showed that. He shows Caliban similarly being put to use. And because they were found on an island, and this relates to the time when they started finding the Americas and finding, it wasn't that long after, where all trade was beginning but I think it's interesting that he writes about it and shows categorically what the behavior is, that it's not nice behavior and leaves you to make the judgment about it. And at the very end, he acknowledges he has committed crimes. I mean, it's in the epilogue, as you yourselves would pardoned be, let your indulgence set us free. So he knows full well he hasn't behaved well.
Right. And freedom is such a central theme to that play. One of the last things he does is set Ariel free, sort of completing his arc. So
there's an incredible book by Margaret Atwood called Hagseed, which really,
I love that book,
really fully explores all the themes of imprisonment and freedom.
Yeah.
Within the context of The Tempest. Now, that does it far more justice than I could ever do with my little production.
Well, speaking of the resonance of the plays, how do you think that in creating, these plays that have, were written 400 years ago, how can we keep them relevant for modern audiences?
Play them. Play them. Don't make them sacred. Play them, play with them. Play them for the audience.
Yeah.
I think it's all about, if it's not for the audience, who's it for?
Exactly.
And I think if, for example, one of the things I always struggle with at the beginning of a play, any play, modern play, Shakespeare, it doesn't matter, is when you get loads of name references. It's just, you read a book as well sometimes, if you get lots of name references and you don't know who the people are yet, you haven't really met the characters. It's really difficult to keep a handle on them whilst you're trying to absorb everything else as well. So we've kind of done a little cheat sheet on this production, which is that when Prospero is talking to Miranda, he conjures each of the people as he speaks to them, and they sort of appear like something like a football.
Oh, I love that.
In the UK, we have, I don't know, but we have these, before football matches, there are these sort of avatars of the players that turn up, sort of photographs with their stats,
we have that too.
Brilliant. It's somewhere between that and one of the moving pictures in Harry Potter, the moving photographs. So they're slightly animated, not frozen, they're slightly animated, but they're not really present. They're sort of holograms of themselves. And people have read into that language straight away, because they have that sort of cinematic vocabulary now, or the sports or televisual vocabulary, and they get what that is. And by presenting each of the characters as he's giving the backstory about them, it just makes it absolutely clear when they appear two scenes later who they are. And that's been very well responded to. And that was something that we found in the rehearsal process. I mean, Shakespeare doesn't make it easy. He, one of the rules of playwriting is kind of show, don't tell. And after you had The Tempest, which is very nice and lively, what you get is a 20-minute scene where he it's just all exposition. He's filling in the whole backstory. Yes. And it's like, you're not supposed to do that.
No, Shakespeare. Yeah, exactly. That's true. What themes do you see resonating with the audience most in this production, do you think?
I think it's the coming out after a long time of mm-hmm. being away. They very much enjoy being together, laughing together, finding the comedy together. We've made a... There's a moment where Caliban finds two new friends in Trincula and Stefano. And mm-hmm. they, because they're drinking, they've got bottles on stage. So we've created a version of the peanut vendor, which we call the pignut vendor because Caliban digs pignuts with his nails. And they play it on these bottles.
Oh, so, that's amazing.
Yeah. As I said, there's music throughout. We've also got the incredible Mark Carlisle, you know, playing mandolin. At the end. He plays guitar throughout, but also plays the mandolin beautifully for our sort of farewell number at the end.
That's beautiful. I imagine taking these instruments from location to location must be difficult. What are some of the, you know, joys and challenges of touring this production?
Chairs are a challenge. Helicopters. What else? All the outdoor stuff but it brings delight too. We had when we were at Camden, we had a fox decided to cross upstage.
Oh my gosh.
And it was incredible, actually. Yes. It wasn't remotely afraid of 250 odd people watching it. It just wandered across and had a good look at everyone. That was hilarious.
It's part of the play.
It was.
How do you prepare for sort of the adjusting of space that has to happen?
I think we keep the playing space the same size and shape. There's a mm-hmm. nice amphitheatre, a lovely sort of ear shape for the players to play in. And also you have to watch that. It can't get too wide, because if you start to stretch the shape, one side can't hear the other and then the music goes out of time. So there are stipulations. You have to kind of anchor it with sort of a little bit of fixed geometry of the space. We've got a little music island. And we've got a little sort of tree that we hang the washing line on so that they can put the trumpery up and things like that. And mm-hmm. and there's a box for a bit of height for when people are either sitting or falling asleep or standing up casting big spells. Really, really amazing.
Well, I'm sure changing the location so frequently, it must give you, you know, new ideas and new ways of seeing it every time. That's so exciting.
We do try to look for the nicest bit of background, so we've got the most sort of trees and shrubbery to play with and sort of backing and it does give a really lovely island feel. It really does to the piece. And that's what I was looking for when I thought, oh, The Tempest. I thought, yeah, I looked at these gardens and thought, what would work in these gardens? And definitely The Tempest works. Even though, strangely, it was first performed indoors.
That's true. You would think it's such an outdoor production. So tell me a bit more about the cast that you've been working with. What are the joys of working with them?
Oh, they're just so phenomenally talented. It is a privilege to have worked with people like this. I mean, they are so talented, not only with the language, with the Shakespeare, with the instruments that they play, such a diverse range of instruments, with the percussion that they play. And I've had an incredible music director, Tom Atwood, who just took what everybody could play and just brought it all together. You know, I came up with a bunch of tunes that I thought would work for the island. I mean, I love bossa nova, so, and I thought things like, you know, Wave and Sway, you know, going into it, I said, can you create a version of Sway that breaks into a storm? And he went away and did it in a day. It was extraordinary what he's achieved. And I wanted to use there's a theme tune for Desert Island Discs that I very much wanted to sort of use, because everybody would be familiar with the tune. And he went away and he found lyrics to it, and that became the opening number. So Tom Atwood is just amazing. And we've had lovely Yarit Dor as well coming in to consult on the movement, which has been great. And, you know, most of all, the fact that Sue Fletcher And Martin Neal have just been so supportive in taking a punt on me because, you know, I didn't have a track record in the same way that other people do. And they just really believed in me. And I feel very, very grateful for that. And I've had the most amazing support from a brilliant AD called Alex Pearson, who is just wonderful, and an incredible crew who go out there and have to put it up every day. They have to create a theatre every day, led by the amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so exciting. That sounds so wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And if people don't make it out this year, how can they find Shakespeare in the Squares next year?
So if you go to www.shakespeareintheSquares.co.uk, you'll be able to see some photographs from this year's production. And when they pick next year's production, it'll all be announced there. And book early, it sells out.
That's amazing. All right, well, thank you so much for joining us. It was a joy talking with you.
Emily, thank you. It's been lovely to be asked. And as I say, I feel very grateful and very, very lucky. Thank you.
Thank you so much for tuning in to Scurvy Companions, the No Sweat Shakespeare podcast. No Sweat Shakespeare is a literary education website devoted to making Shakespeare more accessible. Visit us online at nosweatshakespeare.com to read play summaries, monologue and character analyses, Shakespeare history, and more. And follow us on Facebook and Instagram at No Sweat Shakespeare and on Twitter at Easy Shakespeare. We hope you'll join us again next time.